Welcome to Off Message. I'm Tim Alberta.
The job of Congress is one of the checks, as the founders gave us, right, to check the executive branch, no matter who's there, whether it's free trade issues, NAFTA, whatever it might be. My job in Congress will be to look at it and make sure it's in the best interest of the people of Texas. But there is much to be done, right? If there was 1,000 miles to go, we've gone maybe 50 miles.
Hey, thanks for coming back. My debut edition was a learning experience. Frankly, this is tougher than I thought it would be, but your feedback has been most appreciated. Jessica and Maureen warned me to cut back on the sports banter. Ladies, I'll try my best. Please bear with me. Alexander and Jason thought I should have interrupted Steve Scalise a little bit more, pressing him on things he said. You know, I probably should have. Honestly, finding the right balance here between an interview and a conversation is tricky, but we'll get there. And Vicky told me she hopes Scalise is the next Republican Speaker of the House, in another decade or so. Something tells me Vicky is hoping for a hashtag blue wave. If there is a blue wave, this week's guest is unlikely to be victimized. His name is Chip Roy. He's the Republican nominee in Texas's 21st Congressional District, a reliably red seat being vacated by incumbent Republican Lamar Smith. Roy has been a power player behind the scenes in Texas for years. Wherever there's been a conservative candidate or cause, it's a good bet he was involved. Now he's striking out on his own, running for public office, and, barring a stunning upset, coming to Congress following the midterm elections. Roy is an uncompromising conservative. As chief of staff to Senator Ted Cruz, he was instrumental in executing a government shutdown in the fight over Obamacare. He has been endorsed by the House Freedom Caucus and plans to join the group if elected. But he might not fit in. If anything, those who know Roy will tell you that he is to the right of the Freedom Caucus. While many conservatives in Congress have declined to hold President Trump accountable, specifically on matters of spending, debt, and deficit, Roy's instincts are much more aggressive. When we sat down in San Antonio, he was careful not to telegraph his conflicted feelings about Trump, a man whose candidacy he vigorously opposed in 2016. But he made clear that his expectations for a unified Republican government have not been met. And if elected, he said, he's prepared to push the Republican Party harder and farther to the right. You are a bit of a Republican Renaissance man. You're a lawyer and a businessman. You served as chief of staff to Senator Ted Cruz, and you were a prosecutor in the Texas Attorney General's office, among other things. But your true claim to fame, the most interesting line item on your resume, is that you were the ghostwriter for Governor Rick Perry's book, Fed Up, which was the springboard, the unofficial springboard for his 2012 presidential run. Now, of course, we all recall that in 2012, while running for president, Rick Perry famously forgot the third federal agency that he wanted to eliminate.
And which one was that?
And I wonder if you are the person responsible, because if he had written the book himself, he would not have forgotten. There's no way he would have forgotten which agency he wanted to eliminate.
Well, he certainly wouldn't forget it now, right? Given that he is the Secretary of Energy. No, it was a great honor and great blessing to work for Rick Perry. He's a friend. And it was great working with him on that book. It is his book. And I was delighted to do so. I had been a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and we had mutual friends and family through the Texas A&M network here in UT or here in Texas. And I connected with him, and we had a meeting of the minds about what he wanted to accomplish. And so we worked on it, and it was designed to try to marry his experience as the governor of Texas and what that meant, and why Texas was so successful and so powerful in terms of our economic growth and so forth, with the philosophy behind that. You know, I respect him immensely, and you joke about that it may or may have been my fault. In some ways, I joke it might have been, because when I was working for him on his presidential campaign, you will know that I'm a cancer survivor, and I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma the week before he kicked off his campaign. In fact, I was supposed to be in Charleston, South Carolina for the kickoff, which was at the Red State Gathering, you might remember. And instead, I was at MD Anderson in Houston starting my treatment. But he would call me frequently from the road after debates or around that time, offering scripture, offering prayer. And so I joked with him one time after one of the debate performances. I said, I guess it was my fault that you forgot the agency. You were thinking about me, weren't you? So there may be some truth to that.
You know, it's interesting. I remember how the book was meant to convey the message that Rick Perry had at the time, that, look, Washington is a disaster. The federal government has become overbearing and intrusive. And he even had a quote at some point to the effect of, you know, you couldn't pay me to go to Washington, right? Like, get me as far away from that place as possible. Mm-hmm. But later, he said, by way of explaining why he was running for president, that in order to sort of get a handle on Washington, you need to send people to Washington who hate Washington, mm-hmm. right? And you, I get the sense, in running for Congress, are taking something of a similar approach. That you believe that in order to sort of get a collar on Washington and to bring it under control, that you need an influx of lawmakers who fundamentally distrust and dislike Washington.
I think that's a fair statement. I think maybe you overstate a little bit by saying, quote, hate Washington, although it probably feels like that at times for those of us who have a strong concern about the swamp, as the current president refers to it. But prior to President Trump's run in 2016, where he obviously branded that term, there were a number of us who had been expressing our concern about the power and the growth in Washington and how fundamentally at odds that is with our nation's founding and frankly the greatness of our country over its history. The first chapter in the book, Fed Up with Governor Perry, is titled, if I remember correctly, America is Great, Washington is Broken. And that was capturing what Governor Perry and I had in our meeting of the minds about his great love for all that he saw occurring in Texas, like I mentioned a second ago, and how at odds that is with what we were seeing in Washington. So much growth and so much interference. And we, you know, one of the things I talk about on the campaign trail a lot is how divided a lot of people believe the country currently is. And I think they're right. There is a lot of division. But how much of that is stemming from a top-down approach, a one-size-fits-all solution on every issue under the sun that's causing so many Americans to be at each other's throats? I don't want to wake up on Sunday morning, you know, zeroing in on Meet the Press, trying to figure out what's going to be the next fight of the day. I want to wake up on Sunday morning and go to church with my family, go have some, you know, fun in the afternoon on Sunday and, you know, stay focused on our communities, stay focused on our cities, our state, to helping the veteran down the street, whatever you might be doing in your neighborhoods. And really, Washington, it should be about making sure we preserve and protect the republic, defend the nation, secure the border, and then get largely out of the way. Balance the budget. Do your job. I think that's where the tension is. I believe that if you want to reunite the country, let Texas be Texas. Let California be California. We can have fights all day long in Austin over whatever issue under the sun. Or here in San Antonio, we've got issues where there's a question about mandatory sick leave and how that works. Have that debate in San Antonio. Have that debate in Austin, Texas, right? We don't need to have all these fights in Washington. Brooklyn can be Brooklyn. Texas can be Texas. It's a great thing about our country.
Now, not to belabor the point about Rick Perry's book, a final thought on that, though, because it strikes me one of the really controversial passages in that book was about Social Security and comparing it to a Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm. And it got a lot of headlines at the time. And if for no other reason, I find it interesting now because there was a time in which Republicans prioritized entitlement reform. It was central to the modern Republican mm-hmm. doctrine. And yet today, with a unified Republican government in Washington, D.C., Republican-controlled House, Senate, White House, there is no talk of entitlement reform whatsoever. Really, it was one of the white whales for Speaker Paul Ryan, and they have mm-hmm. made really no attempt whatsoever to rein in entitlement spending. How disappointed are you about that, and why do you think that is?
Well, none of the lack of accomplishment in doing that is going to change the fact that by 2026, Medicare is slated to be bankrupt, that Social Security is slated to be fully underwater, I think, in 14 years or something like that. You might know better than I, early 2030s, I think. None of that has changed. What has changed, I think, is the willingness of Republicans, in my opinion, to do the hard work of governing and focusing on the very central issues they need to do and roll their sleeves up and work. And one of the reasons I think that is that parties, both parties, have gotten so focused on retaining power, so focused on what do we do to make sure we keep the majority. That reference in the book was a reference to recognizing that when you've got a system that is structured like a Ponzi scheme, right? Structured in a way where you've got all of the money coming into it now from those who aren't retiring to fund those who are retiring. And when you get upside down with the baby boomer generation, well, then you don't have got the resources there to do it.
The math doesn't work.
Right? The math just doesn't add up. That's not a partisan statement. That's not a statement about what Social Security should or shouldn't be. It's a reality check. Now we've got, unfortunately, Republicans who, what did they just do in September? Passed a massive spending bill that has now got us, in the latest news from 2 days ago, said it's going to be upwards of $800 billion, $750 billion, I can't remember the number, of deficit spending. And we know we're heading to a $1 trillion deficit spending again. This is the party that 6 years ago was campaigning against the president, then President Obama. We need fiscal responsibility. Yep. We need to reduce deficits. It's just got to be the willingness to do your job. Speaker Ryan was right to focus on entitlements, but he needed to drive the train forward to get everybody to work together. Now, here's the critical point. When the Voting Rights Act was on the floor of the Senate in the 1960s, how long was it being debated? I think it was on the floor for four straight months. We've had multiple times in our history when the founding fathers came together and the Continental Congress got together to draft the Declaration. What did they do? They met for months on end to finally get to agreement to do it. And now what do? We throw a bill down on the floor that was cooked up in some back room and they said, all right, vote on it and let's have a vote next Wednesday and then let's go home on Thursday. That's not how you can get things done.
How do you make sense of, look, you mentioned a minute ago, under Barack Obama, I mean, there was blood in the streets, right? I mean, figuratively speaking. But in 2010, when that Tea Party wave first came to Washington, then 2 years later, when Senator Ted Cruz, your former boss, when that second Tea Party wave came to Washington, the message was clear and it was very urgent that America was in danger of going over the cliff if something was not done dramatically to change course. And specifically, I'm wondering about the role that President Trump plays in this, because he is someone who made very little mention of reducing the debt, reducing the deficit, of cutting spending. He talked famously about it being a great time to borrow. So he is not someone who has ever campaigned on this idea of fiscal responsibility that had seemed to be fundamental to what Republicans had stood for generations.
Well, I think if you take a step back and see what's been accomplished in the last 20 months, we've seen things that make us happy, to your point, right? But you are rightfully pointing out that some of these core issues that drive not just conservative base, but our overall perspective and the belief that government should be limited is that spending matters, that the healthcare freedom issue that we all want to talk about, not just Obamacare repeal, but healthcare freedom and, you know, border security, other issues where we've not seen them get it across the finish line. I am basically of the belief that this is it. If Republicans are given another chance this November, and we'll see what happens, I'm hopeful that we will still be in the majority and have the chance to do the right thing. If we're given that responsibility and fail, well, woe is us, because I don't believe we're going to get any more bites at the apple.
Well, in so many ways, Trump's rise could be pegged to the failure of the Republican Party to deliver on many of its promises during the previous 5 or 6 years of the Obama True. Administration since 2010.
That's right.
So let me ask you this to zero in on it more concretely. What would you say the difference is today between conservatism and Trumpism?
Well, here's my view on that. Conservatism at its core is a belief in the Constitution, limited government, and giving people the ability to live their lives unfettered by government interference, and so that we preserve and protect the liberties that God gave us. And we believe that generates wealth and opportunity, and importantly, empowers people at communities and the state level to be able to do the things we want to do to help one another, whether it's the Christian principles of wanting to help your neighbor and do unto others, or whatever it might be driving your morality. We believe in America of doing good, helping people through charities, through community action, through churches, through Boy Scouts, through groups and organizations, whatever it might be. That is the conservative ethos. And unfortunately, because as I alluded to before, and as you've referenced, the actions in Washington get everything focused on Washington action to, quote, solve problems. And that seeps into supposedly conservative mindset and rhetoric as well. And they feel like, well, we've got to be for something and we've got to go do something. And then that results in more government spending and more programs to solve some problem and takes us farther away from our core constitutional values and those things that we believe would rise all boats, give people opportunity, and give them the chance to the American dream. I'm not sure I can go through and define or even want to try to define Trumpism versus conservatism. What I believe that we see right now is that the swamp or the establishment or the status quo or whatever you want to call the inner workings of Washington, D.C., which were not working, needed to be challenged. And that challenge began years ago. You mentioned the Tea Party, but it began when Mike Lee was elected instead of Bob Bennett, Ted Cruz instead of David Dewhurst, Rand Paul instead of Trey Grayson in Kentucky, Marco Rubio instead of Charlie Crist in Florida. Those were tectonic shifts in the party. And we saw the rise of the Freedom Caucus. You've now got a block of people in Washington who are saying, I'm going to represent the people and the conservative values that the people sent me here to represent. And that's at odds with the sort of power brokers that want to maintain control at all costs.
But ever since Trump won the presidency, and ever since there was that initial skirmish over the first healthcare repeal and replace plan early in the Trump administration, the Freedom Caucus has really been brought to heel by Trump. And you have some members of that group, Mark Sanford and Justin Amash, among others, who have been pretty vocal about that, saying, hey, I thought we were sort of the independent-minded ones. I thought we weren't just the reflexively partisan Republicans here on Capitol Hill. But it seems that Donald Trump has very successfully not just remade the party in his image, but that he has been able to sort of coalesce the party behind him. And I'm wondering, as a guy who's probably going to join the Freedom Caucus, is that a source of concern for you when you think about the runaway spending, when you even think just more broadly about Article 1? We heard so much about Article 1 during the Obama years from conservatives on the Hill. You don't hear much about it anymore.
Well, follow my campaign and you'll hear me use the phrase, make Article 1 great again. Which I've said.
Is there
before.
A hat? Have you made hats?
I have a hat. No, I'll do a blue hat maybe or something. But look, I think that this is really important no matter who's in the White House. The job of Congress is one of the checks, as the founders gave us, right, to check the executive branch no matter who's there, whether it's free trade issues, NAFTA, whatever it might be. My job in Congress will be to look at it and make sure it's in the best interest of the people of Texas. But there is much to be done, right? If there was 1,000 miles to go, we've gone maybe 50 miles. And so now we got to focus on the things that the people really want to see done. We have to have healthcare freedom. We've got to get it fixed. We've got to balance the budget and we've got to secure the border.
You mentioned a minute ago the concept, the elementary concept, of course, of checks and balances and the legislative branch serving as a check on the executive branch. I think over the last 21 months on Capitol Hill, many Republicans will acknowledge that maybe they have not been sufficiently muscular, sufficiently aggressive in checking the Trump administration, certainly as far as oversight is concerned. Do you share that concern that Republicans should be, if for no other reason than to preserve their credibility for the next time there is a Democratic president, that they should be more aggressive, especially in terms of, for instance, calling for the president to release his tax returns? You've had a couple of very lonely Republicans on the Hill call for that. There are concerns about financial interests in foreign countries and entanglements. Do you believe that the president should release his tax returns, or if not, that the legislative branch should compel him to do so?
I think that we should have a robust debate in the Congress and decide whether it's in the interest of the country to have every president release every tax return. I mean, is Congress going to release every tax return, every member of Congress, member that's being brought up for confirmation? I think that, you know, we can have a robust debate about that. But for me, the question is, that's a lot of noise, okay, about a particular topic people can look at. And if Congress wants to look at that, fine. But where are we in actually solving the problems that people right here at home, here in Texas, are concerned about?
So let's talk about Texas a little bit. Obviously, there are many Republicans in the delegation who feel that President Trump's concept of a border wall is not entirely feasible and that it would not be entirely effective. And there is some conversation coming out of the White House that he has begun to soften a little bit and that he has begun to understand that his initial vision is not something that's really executable. If you, Chip Roy, were placed in charge of securing the border, very concretely, and as it relates to the issue of a fence, of a barrier, what would you like to see?
As you know, I spent time on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I've worked on this issue for a number of years in various capacities. And I was in the Attorney General's office as well, and in the U.S. Attorney's office, prosecuted those who were here illegally. I'll tell you this. I've spent a lot of time with folks on the border. I was just down in Laredo, down with the Border Patrol. And of the 72 miles of the Laredo sector, how many miles of that 72 miles do you think has not a fence, not a wall, but even a road that allows you to navigate parallel to the Rio Grande? 2 miles. Go sit in a car with a Border Patrol agent and listen to them explain what they deal with. They're there at 11 o'clock at night. They're by themselves. They can't see the river through the cane that is running all alongside the river. They can only navigate 2 miles of that whole sector. Cartels have operational control of the other side of the river. They've got no cell signal often. They often don't have a radio signal. And they're being asked to man our border and to secure it. Again, with cartels having operational control. The result is that MS-13 is strengthened. The result is that cartels choose who comes across the river. And if you try to come across yourself through a coyote, you are then at the hands and the mercy of the cartels. And so we've allowed that to be the case. Women getting sold and children getting sold into the sex trafficking business, children riding on the top of train cars. We've allowed that to become a broken system that is bad for immigrants and bad for our sovereignty. So what do you do to fix it?
Of course you need physical barriers. In Southern California in the mid-1990s, there was no real good fencing on a good chunk of the border. And we had over 600,000 apprehensions per year in Southern California. Now, we have triple-layer fencing in Southern California. Those apprehensions are down to the 30,000 range. That it works. Now, people say, well, it didn't work. People have migrated to Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. That indicates it actually worked. Texas has unique features. Ranch land, we don't have many federal lands in Texas. God bless Texas. But we've got ranchers that need access to the Rio Grande. We've got Big Bend National Park, where you've got a lot of beautiful vistas. Fine. You know what? Start down in the Gulf of Mexico. Start down in Brownsville. Start down in the valley and start working up the river. Build fences. Clear the cane. Make sure that people have the resources they need, the Border Patrol agents to cameras and radios and better cell signals. Give them everything they need. Work up. And when you get to a rancher and that rancher says, well, I need access to the river. Awesome. We're going to give you a 100-yard opening or a 500-yard opening or whatever you need. And then we'll put cameras and we'll make sure there's a Border Patrol person manning that post.
So the inverse view, or perhaps the competing view that you will hear from some Republicans, including Will Hurd, the congressman down in the 23rd District of Texas, who represents more border than any member of Congress in America, he would say, look, we should be using a technological barrier in all areas except where you really need the fence. In other words, we should be using fiber optic cables, advanced monitoring technology, more boots on the ground, but only build fence where it really makes sense. So as opposed to the 700 miles or so that has been discussed, he's talking about maybe a few dozen miles or maybe up to 100 miles in the areas where it's really clear that it would be effective. But you don't buy that argument?
I like Will, and Will's a friend, and we've had some good conversations about this topic. And I think there'll be a lot of agreement there, but the on a lot of different parts of this. But I believe that the fencing, the wall, whatever you want to call it.
Physical.
The physical barrier is critically important for a good chunk of the border.
Describe to me your mentality coming in. Obviously, you worked as chief of staff for Senator Ted Cruz, and he and you, along with him, developed reputations as sort of sharp-elbowed operators in those first couple of years when he was on the Hill, most famously with the government shutdown in 2013. And I've talked to some folks in town. It's interesting. Some of the leadership folks and their allies are a little nervous about Chip Roy. This guy's going to be to the right of the House Freedom Caucus. And then I talked to folks in the conservative movement who are thrilled that you're coming to town. They think that they're getting a needed reinforcement and a guy who, quite frankly, might not go weak at the knees the way that some of the other so-called conservatives in Washington have done. How do you view your role in today's Republican Party if you arrive in Congress next year?
My role is to represent the people of the 21st District. The lion's share of the people I talk to in the district, the vast majority, want execution on the things we've talked about. Healthcare freedom, border security, balance the budget, get out of the way and let Texas do its thing. And so that's the lens I look through if I go to Washington. My job is to set the baseline. I don't want to have a discussion about healthcare freedom or repealing Obamacare that starts with the false notion that somehow pre-existing conditions governs how you establish insurance and structure it. And we're viewing it through the lens of insurance coverage instead of making sure that people have access to doctors and can afford healthcare. So you reset the baseline. And it's the same thing with spending. We should walk in there and the first, you know, go in there and say, we're not going to pass anything until we've passed a five-year balanced budget and we've appropriated to that five-year balanced budget. And part of that appropriation is military spending and border security.
But you're going to be a very lonely voice if that is the approach you take.
You know, Sam Adams, you know, famously said that, you don't need a majority, but you need a tireless minority willing to set brush fires of freedom. I believe that.
But institutions are slaves to the status quo. And you know this from having come up to Capitol Hill with Ted Cruz as his chief of staff. And you guys saw how even in that moment, in that era of the Tea Party being ascendant and this huge influx of young, conservative, sort of ideologically charged lawmakers who would come, not viewing the Democratic Party, even in many cases, as its primary opponent, as the Republican establishment, as needing to sort of shake the Republican Party from its slumber, right? And yet, while there were some gains made, ultimately, the things you're talking about, balanced budget amendment, cutting spending, these things were not realized. So would it not require some sort of dramatic change in the leadership of Congress or in the processes of Congress or both for these things to happen that you're describing?
It might. And we'll see what happens when we get there in January. And we'll see, Lord willing, if I'm elected, and we'll see what happens. But I'll tell you, process does matter. It's kind of what I'm getting at. We ought to think about this differently. We shouldn't be thinking about it in terms of all of the discussions that happen behind closed doors and then come together and say, okay, leadership drops a bill and says, this is the bill. This is what's going to work. And then people on the left and the right of the spectrum then say, well, that's not good enough for me. And that's not good enough for me. That's exactly what we saw happen on healthcare. And that's exactly what we saw happen on immigration. The better approach is the approach that we've seen work in our history on complex issues. You work at it and you start twisting arms and you start doing all the things you need to do, but you put it on the floor and you debate it. And then you make people vote, right? That's what you do. That's what we need to do now. Put a balanced budget on the floor as an issue and say, we're going to pass a 5-year balanced budget. Heck, I think we should pass a 1-year balanced budget, but that people would view that as too hard. So fine, pass a 5-year balanced budget. The White House sent one up to Congress last year. What did they do? Congress laughed it back down the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Because they knew that President Trump wasn't serious about it.
Well, the OMB certainly sent it up there. And I don't know that the president wasn't serious about it if his OMB director sent it up. What I know is that Congress then didn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And Congress's job, as Article 1, should be to balance the budget.
If Republicans are to hold on to the House majority in a couple of weeks, Kevin McCarthy is presumed to have the first bite of the apple. Would you vote for Kevin McCarthy as Speaker?
I've already said that I'm supporting Jim Jordan for Speaker. Jim and Mark Meadows were hugely influential and supportive for me as I was going through the primary. They're friends that I've worked with together, and I'm friends with Kevin McCarthy and worked with him for the first time, if I remember correctly, in 2008 on the platform committee in the Republican convention. I was the lawyer for the committee. But so I've known him for a long time. But I've publicly supported Jim, and we'll see what happens with all of that. I do think Jim's right when he says we're going to do what we said we would do.
But let me reframe, because obviously you are aligned with Jordan, and the House Freedom Caucus has supported you in your campaign. But the expectation is that there's a pretty hard ceiling, pretty low ceiling on Jordan's vote total, that he could maybe get 40 or 45 votes. He's not going to be the next Speaker of the House. Everybody around him realizes that. So if, in fact, then it gets to a second ballot, you are forced to choose Steve Scalise or Kevin McCarthy. That appears to be, at this point, what would be the binary choice. Would you be prepared to vote for either one of those gentlemen?
Well, I think it would do a disservice to the process for me to look beyond the first vote. We need to have a vote in the conference. Should I be elected? Again, we're presupposing things that we're not there. We've got 3 weeks till election day. But were I to be elected, we need to have a vote in the conference, and we need to have a debate, a robust debate about the future of the party. I want to have a commitment from whomever is going to lead the party that they will do that. And they will fight to do that. And I want to know what their baseline is, because leadership signals matter. But that's what I want. I want to see a serious plan from whomever is emerging to lead the party forward.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Now, we've talked about President Trump a little bit, and I don't want to spend the entire conversation on him, because Lord knows there's enough material. I know from your time with Ted Cruz during the 2016 campaign and far previous to the 2016 mm-hmm. campaign, that you were not always a fan of Donald Trump, that you had been sort of vocally opposed to him at various points. And I wanted to even check my memory on that to make sure before we did this interview. And in talking with some folks around Cruz, they said, yeah, Chip was tip of the spear. I mean, Chip was a vocally never Trump guy. Would you dispute that? I mean, you're making a face like perhaps that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, I was a vocal supporter of Senator Ted Cruz, and I was making sure that I put all my energy in trying to get Senator Ted Cruz elected president. I would not have suggested or categorized myself as never Trump. What I was making sure that I was articulating the right message for Ted Cruz, whether it was as his friend while I was in the working for the state here in Texas. I had my job here, but then when I left to go work for him. For a super PAC that was supporting him, mm-hmm. I worked hard on that in that endeavor, because that was what was critically important to do it. By the way, I was working with Kellyanne Conway and a few other people that are now in the Trump administration doing just that and making sure we were trying to advance the cause for Ted Cruz.
You mentioned Kellyanne Conway. It's a great example of how, and Reince Priebus, another one who mm-hmm. was never crazy about Donald Trump as a candidate, mm-hmm. wound up becoming his chief of staff. So there are certainly examples of people who came around on Donald Trump. I'm interested in your perspective. I dug up this old tweet from you, and this was from February of 2016, so in the heat of primary mm-hmm. season, where you said, @real Donald Trump supports Planned Parenthood, which kills babies and puts them in a freezer. government funding of healthcare, and Palestine, present tense. And I'm just curious, has your thinking evolved on Trump? How do you view him now as opposed to this time, say, 2.5 years ago?
Sure. Well, I think we should all be extremely critical and extremely circumspect of anybody running for office. That's our job as Americans. We should view whether it's Ted Cruz, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's somebody in the Congress, whether it's me. We should all be looking at it through the eye of, are you doing what you said you would do? Are you representing me the way I think you should? Are you following the Constitution? Are you going to keep spending down? Are you going to do things I want you to do? And I was viewing it through that lens. And I think it was reasonable for Americans to go, well, wait a minute, you know, who are you and what are you about? I knew what Senator Cruz was about. I'd worked for him. I was his chief of staff. I had prayed alongside of him. I had worked side by side with him to try to fight Obamacare and try to cut spending and try to stop amnesty when it was being tried. And so I knew where he was, right? There was no question. So we saw the campaign unfold, and I did my job to try to push back and try to make sure that we got Senator Cruz elected. May 3rd of 2016, that went a different way. And, you know, I think that the president should be viewed through the lens of what he's doing for the country. Again, I don't always agree with him on every way he tweets or everything he says. But I do know that if you look through what we've accomplished, it is really, truly hard to be critical, honestly, from a conservative perspective on a lot of fronts. There are some. I'd like to be better on spending. But I really, you know, think that if you look through what we've accomplished on regulatory relief, on tax relief, on judges, on the embassy in Jerusalem, on taking on the swamp, and truly changing the game in Washington from that perspective, it's hard to argue with those results, even if I might, you know, have issue with one or two things where you don't agree with everybody, as they say.
We've seen no shortage of enthusiasm at the national level and lots of glowing pieces written in national outlets about Beto O'Rourke, and certainly, he is running a campaign that has Democrats in Texas enthusiastic. And I'm wondering, as you campaign on the ground in your congressional district, what strikes you about the O'Rourke campaign? Obviously, you two are not ideological soulmates.
Sure.
Have you seen anything that gives you pause, gives you concern that he could stage a historic upset over Ted Cruz on Election Day, becoming the first Democrat to win statewide here since 1994?
No. Because I do expect Senator Cruz to win, and I do believe that that'll hopefully be a sound victory. But we'll see. We've got a lot of work to do over the next 3 weeks, and we're working hard on the ground to make sure that happens for him, for me, and for others up and down the ticket. But what I think is behind it is something that I actually campaign on all the time. This is a function of a mix of Democrats outside of Texas wanting to be able to try to turn Texas blue, right? It's a concerted effort. They're not shy about it. It's open. Act blue and all the things that are going on. It's very purposeful. But secondly, what's interesting is there are the Democrats within Texas who are not being successful in selling their ideas and visions in Texas in terms of gaining power within Texas, are teaming up with outside of Texas Democrats to try to figure out how to get power with all the money coming in. I mean, $38 million doesn't just grow on trees. And in terms of the Beto mania, look, if you spend $4 million on signs and you blanket the state with signs so that there's a bunch of, you know, cool hipster black signs all over the state of Texas and yards, people get sort of this sense of enthusiasm. But I'll tell you, on the ground, the response has been almost inverted, right? Republicans are going, wait a minute, why are those signs everywhere? Well, we need to show up to vote. Let's get out. Let's make sure we vote.
In fairness, he has had a number of rallies with tens of thousands of people who have come out. So there does seem to be quite a bit of organic enthusiasm. But the question is, are there enough people who are organically enthused that would show up to vote for him?
Sure, but you know, look at those rallies, and you start looking at who's there and why they're there, right? There was this rally in Austin with Willie Nelson, and I'm a big fan of Willie Nelson. My wife's and my first date was a Willie Nelson concert at Stubbs Barbecue in Austin, Texas. My Cocker Spaniel is named Nelson. I love Luckenbach. It's in the district. But Willie is a known liberal, right? This is not surprising, but they have a concert down on the lake in Austin, and you know, you've got, you know, tens of thousands of people that show up. That's Austin. There should be no real surprise about that. As a Governor Perry, you know, probably remember the line he used to use, the blueberry and the tomato soup that is Austin, Texas. Of course, there's, you know, a number of thousands of ex-people that are enthusiastic about Beto O'Rourke. And particularly when you're out there preaching a message about, you know, bipartisanship and getting along and what we need to do to get things accomplished. All of that sounds great. Now let's talk about the issues. Let's go down the list of issues. I do that with my opponent all the time. Do you want single-payer government-run healthcare? Yes or no. Do you want more funding for Planned Parenthood? Yes or no. Do you want border security, or do you want to take assets away and have open borders? I mean, Beto's pretty clear about believing that we ought to limit border security, reduce the amount of spending for walls, abolish ICE or whatever it might be. And these are the kinds of things that there are clear distinctions about where the people of Texas are as a whole versus where they want to take the state.
So you've led me into a conversation I want to close with here, which is about the future of Texas. And obviously, we've heard for years about the changing demographics and the state gradually going to shift from red to purple and then for perhaps from purple to blue. And we may be over our skis here talking about that in the context of 18 or even 20 or 24. This could take a while. But you do have some Republicans, Will Hurd, the congressman from Texas's 23rd district, who has talked about the future of Texas elections being won between the 40-yard lines, that the old model of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans is not going to be sustainable in the long term. Karl Rove also talked a little bit about this. But that would seem to run very much counter to the approach taken by a Ted Cruz, taken by an Attorney General Paxton, a Lieutenant Governor Patrick. I'm curious, you, Chip Roy, probable incoming member of Congress from Texas's 21st district and, you know, widely known as a rock rib conservative, whether you view the demographic changes in Texas as necessarily precipitating sort of an evolution within the Republican Party in Texas, and whether there is going to be a need at some point for something of a gradual shift towards the center, knowing that elections can't just be won by mobilizing the conservative base.
Well, a number of thoughts on that front. First is this assumption by too many on the left, and frankly, even the right or center right, that Hispanic voters, for example, will vote monolithically and in block for Democrats. I don't believe that the evidence backs that up if you look at the polls over time. And I think that is particularly true as we're seeing strong economic growth and opportunity for Hispanic business owners and low unemployment rates for Hispanics and blacks throughout the country. I think we're seeing what the benefit is of having strong policies that will lift people up and give them opportunity. And why I go back to my rhetoric that and my philosophical belief that we have got to unite our country again around the idea we can agree to disagree and then let Texas figure out what's in its best interest, like California do the same. And if you do that, then you de-escalate politics. You reduce the temperature. You lower the heat on those Sunday morning talk shows and on all of the discussion and the divisiveness and all the rhetoric because people aren't fighting over every single issue. Let's let Texas do what we want to do. If California wants to ban straws, have at it. If we want to, you know, have a debate in Texas about what we think are the right gun policies and, you know, what we think works, great.
I remember on election night 2016, I got a text from Chris Wilson, the Ted Cruz campaign's data guru, who said, "Are you looking at these numbers coming out of Harris County? This is terrifying for Texas Republicans in the long term." And in that election, you had Donald Trump among Latinos winning 34% to Hillary Clinton 61%. And among all non-whites, you had Clinton 66%, Trump 29%. You are a smart guy. Surely you can recognize that those numbers are not sustainable over the long term as the Hispanic population continues to grow. The voting age population specifically continues to grow every day in Texas.
Well, but that's the anomaly of looking at one data point in one election in 2016 as opposed to looking across the arc of time and what we've seen with Hispanic voters, whether it's for George W. Bush, whether it's for Ted Cruz, whether it's for Greg Abbott, who have made great inroads in the Hispanic community. And importantly, anecdotally on the ground, talking to Hispanic business owners who love to see economic growth, Hispanic Texans who believe that the rule of law and border security matters, people who don't like it when people who are waiting in line and their families are waiting in line to try to come here, and then people jump the line by coming here illegally and that they bring crime and other elements here, they don't like that.
It sounds like what you're saying in talking about isolating that one data point related to 2016 and Trump's share of non-white voters and of Hispanic voters is that candidates matter, right? And the individual messages matter. George W. Bush won 44% of Hispanics nationally in 2004. And of course, no Republican since then has broken 30% nationally among Hispanics. But to your point, Governor Greg Abbott has done very well among Hispanics, is expected to do even better this fall. So the question is, for Republicans who are concerned about the party's long-term standing among that specific slice of the electorate, should there be worry about lasting damage done by Donald Trump and his rhetoric about Mexican immigrants? And I don't need to go, you know, all the way down the list of the things that he has said that have been perceived to be antagonistic towards the Hispanic community. But is that a concern for you in a state like Texas? A lasting concern? In other words, that the party would be branded as a Trumpian party, and that people will not be able to see individuals like a Greg Abbott or like a Chip Roy or like a, you know, George P. Bush.
Well, I believe that the people of Texas, for sure, I think the American people broadly, often see through the caricatures that are portrayed by the media and portrayed by our political opposition, whoever it may be, the left or maybe the Washington establishment sometimes. Forever, you know, it's society, right? We get fixated on personalities, right? It's a People magazine. It's a, you know,
that's the era we're living in now. Right?
It is. And look, and obviously, you know, President Trump relishes in that and he uses it to his advantage, right? He figures out how to use that to move the needle. That's part of the thing that people have not really still firmly put their arms around. What I'm saying is regardless of that, he too will be gone one day. Ted Cruz will be gone. I'll be gone. We'll all be gone. The question is what are we leaving behind? And I say, put your faith not in princes, put your faith in principles, put your faith in God. We've got a republic that was given to us by the hard work and the blood and the toil of our forefathers who gave us the opportunity to do whatever we want to do.
One thing I was very interested to hear you talk about in your campaign was this idea of a deep state that is in some sense acting as a shadow government and that is unchecked and out of control. And you hear that a lot from Republicans in Washington. And I'm interested for you to elaborate on that a little bit. It always strikes me as interesting because often the most damaging leaks to President Trump have come from within his West Wing, from folks who are close to him, who are trying to leak things from to the press strategically in order to change his mind or to put a scare into him or any number of other things. When you talk about the deep state, what exactly do you mean by that? And what is your real concern?
First of all, the current chief of staff, I think, as we've seen by the recent announcement with Nikki Haley, which was kept undercover, I think a lot of those leaks have kind of dissipated once they've established some order. But if you look at what's happened throughout the administration, you've seen the pushback from deep within the bowels of each of the agencies, right? And I've seen it firsthand. I mean, and I don't want to name names, but, you know, people that I know that are working in different agencies, there are very specific, very direct stories of people that are an entrenched bureaucrat who hide something from the political decision makers who have been empowered by the duly elected president of the United States to make something happen contrary to what they believe would be what the president or the secretary in that question might want to do. Now, let me be honest, this is not a partisan issue. I don't believe that if, for example, if Secretary DeVos in the Department of Education wants to try to push school choice in the District of Columbia, and there's some bureaucrat down in there that she's hired who's a conservative school choice advocate, if a future president comes in and a Secretary of Education doesn't want to advance that policy shouldn't be being advanced by an unelected person deep within the Department of Education. This is why I believe a lot of that needs to be thinned out so that we don't have those issues. Why do we have these massive entities up there that are largely unchecked? The framers knew some about that, right? About this sort of fourth branch of government that could pop up. And we ought to do something to minimize that. Keep in mind, there were only four original departments, right? And, you know, War, the Attorney General, State, and Treasury. And now there's untold numbers of bureaucrats in Washington.
And you brought us full circle from the original question about Rick Perry and his oops moment. So I'm curious, if you were king for a day, would you eliminate any of these departments or agencies?
Sure, I think so. But it's kind of like talking about the wall. I don't want to refer to it as metaphorical as much as I just want the power eliminated and the number of people making these decisions unchecked reduced. I want the spending reduced on all these things. The number of agencies is almost academic. Fine, eliminate one of them. Could you take some of the pieces of the Department of Energy, with all due respect to my former boss, who's currently the secretary, and put it at the Department of Defense because it's nuclear related?
Or Homeland Security.
Sure. It's like a corporate reorganization. You can reorganize all you want. The question is where's the decision-making occurring? How many bureaucrats are there doing it? How many duplicated jobs are there? How much of that should be being done in Washington or not?
So final question, I'll get you out of here on this. It's my favorite question to ask a candidate for office.
Uh-oh.
No Republican is a Republican on every issue, and no Democrat is a Democrat on every issue. Everybody, human beings are complex. I still believe that. What is the one issue that you, Chip Roy, candidate for Congress, are not really a Republican on?
Wow. I mean, that is a tough one. I'll tell you, I would say that one issue where I think we should probably land that I think is appropriate, and this is consistent with my federalism principles, is that I do think that with respect to marijuana, that should be left to the states. I think that is an issue that I think is better left to the states. And then I still think we ought to enforce it internationally and make sure that we're not importing, but that's something that's better left to the states. And that is obviously consistent, as you know, with my general worldview about federalism and leaving things to the states.
Well, that's a wrap on interview number two. How did I do? How did he do? What do you think about Chip Roy, and what kind of congressman will he make? Send me your thoughts, your questions, your comments, and your concerns, as always, at talberta@politico.com. Thank you to our producer, Zach Stanton, to our executive producer, Dave Shaw, and a special thank you to Paul Flav for helping us out with our recording in San Antonio. If you like Off Message, and if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Off Message, coming to you from Chicago with none other than the Democratic savant himself, David Axelrod. We'll see you then.